Okay, good evening, everybody. My name's Robin Archer, and I'm the director of the Ralph Miliband program here at the London School of Economics. And I'm delighted to welcome you all to our joint lecture on rethinking capitalism. We're going to have an innovative two-part lecture by our speakers who'll be setting out some of the arguments that they've have set out in this new book of theirs, Rethinking Capitalism, which you can find outside the lecture venue. Well, it's a real pleasure to introduce our two speakers. Michael Jacobs, his work has focused on the political economy of environmental change, and he was formerly the General Secretary of the Fabian Society and a co-editor of Political Quarterly. He worked for quite some years as a policy advisor to Gordon Brown in government, and he's been a visiting professor at various institutions, including UCL and here at the Grantham Institute at the London School of Economics. And now he's the director of a brand new initiative at the IPPR, Institute for Public Policy Research, the Commission on Economic Justice, which augurs well, I think, for what might be done in this period of time. Mariana Mazzucato, her work has focused on the economics of innovation, and indeed she is the R.M. Phillips Professor of the Economics of Innovation at Sussex University. And the influence of her research, especially I think her book, The Entrepreneurial State, has been widely recognised in the Financial Times, in the New Statesman, the New Republic, and with various prizes and awards. And she's in demand as an advisor to politicians and policymakers around the world, I think would be, people say this, but really around the world. So our speakers are going to speak jointly for about 45 minutes, and then we're going to have a good half hour for questions and discussion. Can I first ask you to join me in welcoming our speakers, Michael Jacobs and Mariana?
Thank you very much indeed, Robin, and thank you to all of you for coming. It's terrific to be here. It's a cold evening, and I'm Mariana and I are very grateful to you for making the effort. Because it's a cold evening, I thought I'd start with a joke. This is a lecture about economics, which, as you well know, is called the dismal science, for very good reason. As an economist, I've been trying to counter that over a long time, collecting jokes about economics. I've been collecting jokes about economics for about 25 years now. I have four. And unfortunately, that was one of them. But I do want to give you one of the other ones, so you can have half of the entire set, which is a story that you may know about a surgeon, an engineer, and an economist who were discussing their respective professions. And they got on to the age of their professions. How old were their professions? And they went back through the Romans and the Greeks and the Phoenicians and the Egyptians. And eventually the surgeon said, look, long before all of those, God created Adam and Eve. And he created Eve from a rib from Adam's body. This was a surgical operation. Clearly, surgery is much the oldest of our professions. Very quickly, the engineer said, long before God made Adam and Eve, he made the world out of chaos. This was an engineering operation. And they both turned to the economist, who thought for a moment and said, "Ah, yes, but who created chaos?" as I say, the dismal science. We are going to talk a little bit about how economists, if not creating chaos, have not fully understood the chaos, if we can use that term, that the Western capitalist system is now in. And in a sense, our story, which this is the book that Mariana and I have edited, our story actually begins at the LSE at a famous moment, famous at least to those people who've heard of it, in November 2008, which, if you recall your recent history, was just after the collapse of Lehman Brothers, when it was beginning to be realised that the financial crisis was going to be very, very significant. And the Queen came to the LSE on a long-standing visit, been arranged for as are these things, for years ahead. She was here to open a new building, but she turned out to be much more interested in the assembled economists gathered in front of her. and she asked them a very simple but very pointed question. Given the scale of the financial crisis, which was then unfolding, why was it that almost nobody had spotted it coming? This question, which is not normally given to 82-year-old hereditary sovereigns to puncture the pretensions of the people who run the global economy and those paid to understand it, but her question, the Queen's question, went to the heart of two huge failures. The first and the largest was that capitalism in its Western form very nearly collapsed at that point. Had it not been for the very swift action of governments, including the UK government, to recapitalise the banks that were failing, which Lehman Brothers was the one that was allowed to go under, but the rest were not, the economic system would have run out of money. You would have gone to a cash point and found that there was no money. And that would have posed immense problems for the whole system. And as we know, it was only the massive injection of public capital into the banking system which kept Western capitalism alive. The second huge failure at that time was, as the Queen hinted, that the economics profession had not properly understood what was happening, did not predict it, by and large, though there were some economists who did, and did not fully understand why it was occurring. And the thesis of our book, Rethinking Capitalism, is that these two failures are related, that orthodox mainstream economics has given us inadequate resources to understand modern capitalism and the multiple crises it now faces, not just the crisis of financial instability, and therefore has contributed to poorly designed and poorly performing economic policy. And our argument, the argument that we make in the book and that the authors collected together in the book make, is that to make better policy, to deal with capitalism's failures and weaknesses, we need better economics, which better understands how capitalism now works and why in many ways it now doesn't. The problems of economics that were revealed in the financial crisis were telling. There was a macroeconomic problem and a microeconomic problem, which neatly encapsulates, in a sense, the problem. The macroeconomic one was that the modelling of the economy that most macroeconomists, people who study the whole economy, were using, did not have the financial sector, the banking sector, properly modelled within them at all. This might seem extraordinary given the scale of the crisis which unfolded in the banking sector, but the reason was that those models assumed that the financial sector largely acted as a cipher through which financial transactions occurred but which did not fundamentally affect them. Now, we now know that that is a complete misunderstanding of how the financial sector and the banking sector work. But it was telling that most of the macroeconomic models which treasuries, which central banks and others were using, economists were using, simply weren't modelling the locus of the problem. The microeconomic problem was one that was gradually revealed and has now been, as indeed the modelling problem, most models now do try and capture some kind of financial sector. The micro problem was that the core thesis which lay behind the deregulation of the financial sector, which in turn led to the creation of the exotic financial instruments, the credit default swaps and derivatives and so on that you may have heard of, whose proliferation led to the financial crisis. The economic theory that underlay the deregulation of the financial market then led to those instruments, which was known as the efficient markets hypothesis, was a core basis of financial regulation, or in fact the relative deregulation. And it was well put by Alan Greenspan, the former Federal Reserve chairman, the central bank governor equivalent in the US. And the argument was that of all the markets in the economy, financial markets had the most information. And with the information at their disposal, people who were dealing in financial assets would price them correctly. Because there was so much information around, these would be efficient markets in which the assets in them would be priced correctly. And by spreading those assets very widely through the use of these instruments, you would be spreading the risk around the economy and the risk would be well under control. We now know that there was absolutely systemic mispricing of assets, that most financial asset holders did not understand the assets they were holding, and that in fact these were incredibly badly priced, the risks were not understood at all, and by spreading these throughout the economy, so banks and insurance companies and others holding assets which they did not fully understand and whose risks were mispriced, you had far from minimising systemic risk to the whole economy, you would spread it throughout. And that was why this turned from a crisis of particular in the American subprime market, very specific kind of asset, into a systemic crisis of the system as a whole. Alan Greenspan was eventually hauled before the Senate and famously said, when asked whether he had got anything wrong in the regulation of the financial system, said slightly disingenuously that he had found a flaw in the theory. What made the crisis in 2008 such a shock, in both senses of the word, was that the mainstream economic view at that time was that that modern economics had largely solved the macroeconomic problem. That we know that capitalist economies are prone to boom and bust, and had previously had periods of rapid inflation or unemployment and so on. What the broad consensus that had been reached was that through independent central banks, inflation targeting, open inflation minutes, macroeconomic fiscal rules which limited borrowing and so on, by and large we could reduce the amplitude, reduce the volatility of the business cycle. Gordon Brown, who I used to work for, as Robin said, never said that we had abolished boom and bust, but the idea underneath it that we had in a way got control of the boom and bust phenomenon was very widely believed. And it was exactly at the moment when economists were feeling most confident, or one might say complacent, that the financial crash hit. Economists don't think this now. Economists would now acknowledge that we are living in a very extraordinary period in which we have not solved our core economic problems at all. What not all of them have recognised, and what Mariana and I point out in the introduction to the book, is that capitalism in Western countries, and we limit this to Western capitalism, capitalism is in China and India and Brazil and other emerging economies, is rather different, although obviously the systems are connected. Western capitalism is now facing multiple crises, and I want to spend a little bit of time just going through these to understand the depth of the problem that we have, and that is the basis of our claim that we need a much richer form of economics to understand it better. So the financial crisis in 2008 was, of course, much the largest financial crisis that we've had since the great crash of 1929. But it was by no means the only one. This is a chart from the Reinhardt and Rogoff book, This Time is Different, which shows the number of financial crises of one kind or another with which the global economy, and this is global, has been beset in the period since the financial deregulation move of the mid-1980s. It starts in the mid-70s, but you can see that it picks up hugely from the mid-1980s. There have, in fact, been multiple crises. Now, part of this is because developing economies have entered the global system, have much more mature banking systems, mature in inverted commas, and so they are more prone. There are more economies that can have that kind of instability. But it does suggest that the capitalist system has become much more unstable than it had before. The crash, you will remember, occurred after a long period of reasonably steady economic growth in most economies, which was widely regarded as had become the norm, in which inflation had been under control, employment in general rose, unemployment fell, consumption and so on seemed to be going well. And that was one of the reasons that economists, macroeconomists, felt that they had things under control. But we know that underlying that period of growth, there were some very deep structural things going on. This is one of them, which is the growth of private debt in most economies. And so underpinning that long period of growth was a greater indebtedness, and of course that was part of the root of the crash. And what we've seen since the crash is the lowest recovery of any recession in the past century. So the thick black line is the current recovery period. The other lines here are the recoveries from previous recessions. And you can see that the recovery has been much slower. It is only in the last 3 years that most Western economies have regained the level of output that they had in 2008, before the crisis. And unemployment has remained stubbornly high in most economies. So only Germany, in all of these economies, and Japan, and it's not a coincidence that it's those two countries, now have unemployment that is less than the period just before the crisis in 2007. All the other economies, while unemployment has fallen, it has not yet fallen back to its levels before then. And of course, the southern European economies, Italy, Greece, Spain, have seen continuously rising unemployment. The UK has performed particularly well on employment. We now have record employment rates, and our unemployment rate is lower than almost everybody else. But this is why. If you look at wages, we have got the lowest wages amongst most the advanced economies, and we've got falling wages over this period. And effectively, the UK, whether by design or omission, has traded employment for wages. So we have a higher employment rate, but we have much lower and declining wages. And this is a peculiarity of the British economy, and I'll show you a few things on this, What we have now in practice in the UK is wages that have been more or less stagnant for a decade, and as the Institute for Fiscal Studies pointed out last week, this is going to go on for another at least another 5 years if the modelling is right, which is the longest period of stagnant wages that we will have had for 70 years. And that is both a cause of and a consequence of productivity growth, which has pretty much stalled since the financial crisis. UK productivity is less than most other competitors, and it has stalled since the financial crisis. So in a sense, it's not surprising that wages growth have stalled too. And the argument that Mariana and I make is that at the root of this problem for Western capitalism is this secular decline in investment. So a decline, which obviously goes with the cycle, but a long-run decline in the ratio of investment to GDP. So how much of our national income do we invest in productive capacity? Investment is the engine of growth, of the engine of income generation, and all Western economies are on a downward trend of investment as a proportion of national income, which is makes it not surprising that they've struggled with growth. And the UK is particularly has a particularly precipitate decline, having already started from a lower base than other economies. There are many reasons for this, which I will actually, I'm not going to show you that one yet, jumping ahead of myself. There are many reasons for this. One of the ones that we point out in the book is that the Western economies, particularly the US and the UK, have become financialized. And by this we mean not just that the financial sector has grown, it has hugely, it's much larger than it was as a proportion of the of national income, and it tends to invest less than the manufacturing that it's replaced, but also that companies have become more financialized. There's been a rather extraordinary trend over recent years for companies to give more and more of their income back to their shareholders rather than to reinvest it in productive capacity. So Bill Lazonik, who's one of the authors of the book, has gathered the data on this, and he has shown that between 2004 in 2013, so in that decade, share buybacks by the Fortune 500, so that's the top 500, largest 500 companies in the world. So share buybacks are where the companies buy their own shares, returning money to shareholders, raising the share price, incidentally raising the incomes of their senior executives, which are attached to the share price. Share buybacks by the Fortune 500 amounted in that decade to a rather remarkable $3.4 trillion. In 2014, these companies returned $885 billion to their shareholders, which was more than their total income. So they were actually taking not just their income in that period, but some savings, and returning it to shareholders. And that money returned to shareholders has not gone into investment. And so we've seen this very significant reduction in investment. And if you look at particular kinds of investment, in manufacturing and research and development, you can see that effect. And we're now living in a very abnormal situation, as most economists would recognise, in which we have near zero interest rates, 0.25% in the UK, at which it's almost impossible to do anything now in fiscal and monetary policy through interest rates. We've had 8 years of quantitative easing, which is the pumping of money into the economies by central banks, and we still have anemic growth. We have a growth which is not responsive to these what look like the kinds of policies that ought to generate growth. And it's given rise to the revival of a thesis which was first expounded in the 1930s of so-called secular stagnation. Larry Summers, the former Treasury Minister, the Harvard economist, has suggested that we may now be in a very abnormal situation in which it isn't possible to get full employment, to get the economy working at its full extent, at positive interest rates at all, and that we are going to need negative interest rates. We already have negative interest rates. There's $13 trillion worth of sovereign debt, that's debt that governments issue, which is now trading at negative yield. So companies are paying governments to look after their money. So we are in a very extraordinary situation here with regard to growth and GDP. This, however, is really only the first of our major problems. The second of our major problems is the one that I've already alluded to, which is stagnant living standards and rising inequality. In the US, real median household income, so that's the middle level of income in the population as a whole, was barely higher in 2014 than it had been in 1990, 25 years before, even though in that period GDP had been risen by 78%. If you want a single fact which may explain the election of Donald Trump in the United States, that seems to me to be it. The US economy in that 25-year period grew by 78%. Median wages, that is half of the population, saw no increase in their incomes during that period at all. The US provides an extreme case of this, but it's true in all developed economies to differing extents that there has been a similar decoupling of GDP growth from wages and household income growth. Across advanced economies, the share of GDP going to labour, that's wages and salaries, fell by 9% on average across all the advanced economies between 1980 and 2007. Why? Because of this. This shows a very significant decoupling in the period since 1999. This is an indexed thing, so this shows the decoupling between national income growth and between wages growth and labour productivity. So labour productivity has risen. It's risen not quite in line with, but in a comparable way to GDP, but wages have not. So workers are not getting the benefit of the labour productivity improvements to which they are contributing. That money that is being generated by those improvements in labour productivity and output per hour has gone to the owners of capital rather than to the owners of labour, the workers. And this is shown in these kinds of graphs. So this is the growth in real after-tax income in the US economy. Where has it gone? Well, you may wonder why there are six bars when these are quintiles. Quintiles are 20% of the population. So this is the poorest 20%. The reason is that the fifth bar is not a full quintile. The fifth bar, this one, goes from the 81st to the 99th. Percentage of the population, and the last bar is the top 1%. So this is where the income has gone in the United States. It's gone almost exclusively to the top 20, but within that to the top 1%. And this shows the change in income of the bottom 99%, the top 1%. So this is an extraordinary concentration of the gains from growth over the last 20 to 25 years in the hands of a really tiny minority of the population at all. It's true in all major economies, but not equally true. So the UK and the US have seen much more concentration of those gains to growth at the top compared, for example, with Germany or France, which have similarly seen that distribution, but by nearly so much. And that, again, is significant. Not all economies behave in exactly the same way. This is the pre-tax and benefit income picture in the UK. So this is your earnings. So not tax benefit, tax credits, benefits or taxes, but before those things, this is where the gains from growth have gone in the period from 1979. Almost nothing of the gains from growth has gone to the bottom third of the population, and almost all of it has gone to the top 20%. Of course, we have a tax and benefit system. Tax takes money away, benefits, tax credits give money to people, and they have affected the distribution of income in the UK a bit. So at the top, you have the Gini coefficient. This is the measurement of inequality. The Gini coefficient for original incomes, that's incomes before tax and benefits, the blue line. And then the bottom, the green one, is after taxes and benefits. So you can see that taxes and benefits have reduced inequality a bit in this period, but nothing like enough to make up for the huge rise in inequality which occurred during the 1980s. Basically, Labour Party policy did have some effect, but not nearly enough to reverse the previous trend. And this has left the UK in this position in the global inequality or in the developed country inequality charts. There are basically three groups of countries here. There is Northern Europe, who all have ratios between top and bottom 10% of of under 8%. There is the US at the other end, which is massively unequal. And there is the southern European economies whose ratios are all above 10%. And the UK, in this particular context, is a southern European economy. Wealth, of course, is even more unequally distributed. That's the distribution of wealth in the UK. Thomas Piketty, in his book Capital, notes that there are increasing returns to wealth, which are exceeding the returns to growth, and this is one of the reasons why wealth inequality is growing greatly. The third set of problems which we identify in the book are the environmental risks that that Western economies now face. This is, for those of you who know anything about climate change, this is a kind of familiar climate change graph. This is the trend of greenhouse gases. It's all probabilistic, so there are ranges of them that we are currently on. This is the baseline if we didn't do any more policy. This is the kind of policy action that we are currently expecting. This is where we need to be if we're to hold the increase in global temperature to 2 degrees, which is what the international community in Paris, and indeed before at the Paris Climate Conference last year, has committed the world to. So we need to be here by 2050. We're somewhere here. The task here is absolutely enormous. It effectively is the complete decarbonisation of our economies, which, given that they are 80% still based on fossil fuels, means that we face a very, very severe environmental problem from climate change. But not only from climate change. We now have a very strong consensus among environmental scientists that we face, as a world, multiple environmental risks. Here are 9 what have been called planetary boundaries, which environmentalists have identified as being at risk, or in some cases the red ones, very considerably, possibly beyond their natural boundaries. And these range from atmospheric ozone, which we now do have under control, to excessive nitrogen and phosphorus in our water systems, which we absolutely do not, ocean acidification and so on. And there's 9 of these. The global economy is now undergoing intense environmental damage, which is generating various serious risks to global growth and prosperity. So, these slides were intended to convince you that we have a problem. Western capitalism is not doing well. The question is, does the economics profession, mainstream and orthodox economists, are we getting to grips with these problems in a way that will enable us to address them? And our argument is that we're not. These problems are not temporary problems. They are structural. They arise from now deeply embedded structures within Western capitalism, and that our argument is to understand them, we need to move away from an orthodox approach, the approach that dominates public debate about economics, about economic policy, and dominates policy itself, and incidentally dominates teaching about economics. We completely recognise that there are many kinds of economists, and many economists would not say they were part of what we term the orthodoxy. But we think it is fair to say that there is a dominant strand of economic thinking which has dominated public debate and public policy making about economics. And it's one with which you'll be familiar. It is, to a neoclassical economist, the Walrasian view of the world, in which sees the capitalist economy as essentially one made up of profit-motivated firms operating in competitive markets, where those markets tend towards equilibrium, where the competition generates efficiency and that generates and maximises, in fact, human welfare, where firms are idealised actors subject to the same pressures in the markets in which they operate, and so essentially acting alike and can be modelled as representative agents, so-called, and where it's competition that generates innovation, which generates growth. This theory, which many of you, I'm sure, will recognise, absolutely recognises that markets do not always work well. And a core component of it is the theory of market failure. Where there are monopolies, where there are information asymmetries, externalities, public goods, markets fail. And this then prescribes, in the orthodox approach, interventions of various kinds from public policy. But the theory also insists upon the potential failure of policy. So not only is there market failure in the model, but there is also state or government failure. And in practice, policy over the last 25 years has been dominated by the fear of government and state failure. So yes, it's been accepted that there are market failures, but the overwhelming consensus, sometimes called the Washington consensus, has been that state failure is much more of a risk. So the orthodox prescription in policy and in debate has been that we should be trying to minimize state action insofar as possible. We should be looking towards balancing budgets. We should be using austerity policies in the current context, where governments should not be seeking to influence the patterns of investment that private actors make, for fear of crowding them out. That's the theory. Where it's been argued that because private sector actors are more efficient operating in markets, we should be outsourcing and privatising utilities and public services, creating markets with private sector actors. And where inequality has been allowed as the price of entrepreneurship and growth. This theory and the public policy prescription which has followed from it is beguilingly simple. The fact that its prescriptions have tended to serve those in incumbent positions of power in both government and business has given it an immense grip on public discourse. But our argument is that it's misleading and inadequate. Markets don't behave, as suggested in textbooks, and market failure is an inadequate framework for understanding these structural problems that capitalism faces. These idealized theories assume away many of capitalism's most salient features and ignore much of the evidence about how capitalism isn't working. None of the major problems that I've gone through can be explained well by them. Capitalist economies, we argue, are not theoretical abstractions, but complex and dynamic systems embedded in social and institutional structures and constrained by biophysical environmental laws. They're made up of multiple relationships of real and heterogeneous actors, not idealized representative agents. And Mariana will talk a little bit more about seeing firms not as all the same, but on the contrary as different. In which markets don't tend towards equilibrium, but on the contrary are characterized by dynamic patterns of growth and change. And where the problems we face are not the problems of markets which normally succeed and only sometimes fail, but which are fundamental characteristics and structures. And our argument, and the argument of the various chapters in the book, is that we need a richer form of economics to understand capitalism better and to prescribe successful or more successful policy. Fortunately, there is a rich school, there is a rich vein of tradition within economics to help us do this. The lessons we should have learned from Polanyi, from Keynes, from Schumpeter, from the post-Keynesians, the evolutionary school, the institutional school, ecological economics, and so on, does give us the resources, if we are prepared to use them, to help us understand capitalism better. And in the various chapters of the book, our authors, who range from Joseph Stiglitz, Bill Lazonik, as I've said, Mariana herself, Stephanie Kelton, Stephanie Griffiths-Jones, Colin Crouch and others, using these richer traditions, show how you can achieve a much more sophisticated and better understanding of how capitalism works, and that can then generate what we believe to be much more, at least in principle, much more successful policymaking. And in the second half of our talk, Mariana will talk about how that might be done. Thank you.
Right, so another problem in capitalism is the guys speak too much, not leaving enough time for the women. Just kidding. Right, so telling stories and jokes, I'm really bad at jokes, I won't even try. So, but I'll just say one thing, just coming back to something that happened, how many years after the crisis? 6 years after the crisis. 7 years after the crisis. So in 2015, when the Labour Party lost the election, I was really depressed, not only because they lost the election, but what happened on day two, which was the analysis by some labor leaders themselves of why they had lost. And the really depressing sentence that at least three different leaders or different levels of leaders said was, we lost because we didn't embrace the wealth creators. And I thought, my God, they lost because they have no clue where wealth actually comes from, because what I'm going to be now talking about is that there's a much more collective understanding of wealth creation, where, of course, the wealth creators, meaning business, and this is what these Labour Party people were talking about, the business leaders, the entrepreneurs, of course they're wealth creators. But also if we think about where value actually comes from in long-run value creation, and especially if we look at it through a sort of stakeholder capitalism kind of lens, this understanding that there are different types of wealth creators and, for example, even the taxpayers who are critical, not just for investing, right, in the counter-cyclical kind of way where we need investment that Michael's been talking about hasn't sort of kicked in enough, but also leading in terms of the direction of change. So the state as not just funding, not just taxpayer money, but also affecting not just the rate, but the direction of growth. And in fact, if we look at the last 200 years of capitalism, that direction of growth has been extremely important. And in some ways, we didn't touch on it, Michael didn't touch on it enough, and that's what I will talk about, which is what do we actually know about how periods in which we actually had smart innovation-led growth and investment-driven growth instead of what we've experienced recently in the UK, even after the crisis, which is personal debt and credit-driven growth. What do we know about the role that these different actors have actually played? And the challenges that Michael's great introduction has posed, and which we try to reveal in our introduction of the book, is that, you know, there's huge challenges ahead. This isn't just about getting out of the crisis, especially if you think about his last point about the need for greener and more sustainable kind of growth. These are huge, huge policy challenges. This is, again, admitting that we have to be debating on what kind of growth do we want, because, in fact, before the crisis in the 1990s, there was also quite a bit of growth. It was the wrong kind of growth, right? So precisely because workers had not been seeing their wages increase for almost 20 years, they had to actually take out a lot of credit even just to retain their existing living standards. So that debt-driven growth, personal debt-driven growth, was very problematic. And one should just pause for a minute and just reflect how ridiculous it is, actually, that after the crisis, this whole emphasis on cutting deficits and cutting debts, public debts, completely ignored just that one fact that actually what caused the financial crisis, by the way, was not public debt, it was private debt. And it's just amazing how little that point actually got through. But, you know, coming to the point of that Michael was mentioning in terms of market failure theory and this very narrow way through which the policymaking process has been envisioned, this has been just as much part of the problem. And don't forget Keynes's wonderful quote where he said, you know, these practitioners on the ground, whether they're working the policymaking process in cities or regions or nations, they might think that they are just kind of doing good things and they're, you know, devoid of economic theory. They're not worried about abstract stuff, just doing stuff on the ground, but actually they're often slaves, he said, of defunct economic theory. And what I want to focus on in my time is this kind of defunct way that we even envision the role that economic policy can interact with the economy. And away from a very static and what I would call lame and quite boring way of just seeing it in terms of fixing different types of market failures, which I'll go through in a minute, but also, if you just think of the language that is often used, even by those who really want state intervention, this notion that different types of policies are simply de-risking, right? De-risking business, as opposed to what? Taking risks, right? That's a bit more exciting. Or leveling the playing field instead of tilting the playing field in interesting new directions. You know, if we want sustainable growth, we better tilt it in that direction. Or, administering, regulating, spending. We don't hear the role of different types of policies as being, you know, lead risk takers, envisioning different spaces, again, tilting the playing field, or, what I'll argue in a minute, shaping and creating markets, not just fixing them. And even when we get the IMF and the World Bank finally saying things like, oh, whoops, austerity didn't work, for all the reasons that Michael just told us, at best we get things like, oh, we need to build bridges and roads, you know, infrastructure. Infrastructure is the big idea. You know, that's, you know, it's either austerity or infrastructure, which, Keynes talked about in terms of digging ditches and filling them up again. Sure, that might get you a short-run multiplier, but the real question is what kind of infrastructure, what kind of spending? And one of the interesting things, by the way, for those of you who are either master's or PhD students, there's very little research that has actually shown, even though we have some interesting not very rigorous research, but some interesting insights on this, that actually investments that are driven by a view of what kind of economy we actually want, so whether it's green growth or the IT revolution, actually has a higher long-run multiplier than just digging ditches and filling them up again in the infrastructure sense. Just quickly wanted to point that out because I'm hoping that at least one of the outputs of our talk here will be to get some great research looking at some of these issues. So I won't go through this, but this point, again, that Michael said, that there's this kind of existing framework that simply sees the state coming in and putting bandages here and there is absolutely not what is needed given the immense amount of problems that Michael outlined around inequality, lack of investment, climate change. And, you know, all of these are things that you know about whether you've studied economics or not, right? So you have pollution, which is a negative externality. You might need a carbon tax, again, bandage. Of course, we do need carbon taxes, but, you know, is that really it? We might need we might need during the business cycle when there's a recession some counter-cyclical investments. But this is, again, seen as simply a coordination failure. You get the state to come in and have a stimulus program. But what should the state then do in the boom? Nothing? Was it just correcting that business cycle problem? Or, if we want innovation, we need basic research. Well, private companies won't invest in it because basic research is a public good with very high spillovers, so it's very hard to appropriate the returns, so the state has to come in and fund basic science. All these different types of failures do exist. They absolutely do exist in all these different policies that you might put there, so asymmetric information, where banks don't know what, say, a new startup actually should be valued at, so they don't lend to it, so you need SME finance. All these different types of information or public good failures or coordination failures do exist. The problem is this lens of just thinking that you can come in and put different bandages here and there, is that actually going to get us the kind of transformation and the kind of directionality that is required in order to confront the big problems that Michael was talking about? And this, I often put this up because it took so much to make, so much time to make, using this crazy thing they call Prezi for my TED Talk, and I have to use it to leverage the time. But, you know, this notion that you're just fixing market failures very much reproduces this notion that the state, yes, it's needed, but it's a bit boring, it's a bit bureaucratic, and it's quite, you know, inertial. So at best, it should just be kind of fixing things and, you know, doing the books, getting the right tax system, when all the really interesting, the wealth creation, the wealth creators are in the private sector. And a very different view is one, if we actually look, Michael mentioned Polanyi, at this view of actually, you know, what created markets in the first place? If we're going to talk about markets and the state intervening in those markets, what do we actually mean by the market itself? And Polanyi was absolutely critical in debunking that, if you want, dichotomy from the start, because his book, The Great Transformation, was fundamental in actually showing historically, and it's very much a historical, sociological, anthropological book, that the market itself was actually an outcome of the interactions between different types of actors where the policy-making process itself was one of those lead actors. So policy as market shaping and market creating, not as market fixing. You don't have policy intervening in something called the market. Policy itself is part of that market creation process. And this already is, you know, this is revolutionary stuff. It really hasn't been understood in economics and in so many different policy arenas within economics. If you really take this kind of shaping and creating and governance view, it actually would lead to very different types of policies. And at the end, I'll give you an example just with IPR policy. But even with Keynes, I always say that Keynes, I think, was misunderstood. By who? By the Keynesians themselves, or at least modern-day Keynesians, who at best see the role of, again, government stimulus programs, as I said, in, you know, the down cycle. When actually, if you read him well and not just the general theory, there's all sorts of really interesting things that he said in terms of the need for government policy to really be making big things happen. And not just in terms of, you know, this quote here, you know, don't just tinker on the edges, really do what's not being done at all. Not just phrasing that what's not being done at all in terms of this market failure perspective, but to have a vision. What kind of economy do we actually want? He even had this concept of the socialization of investment, which I'll get to in one of my last slides, which when you read that, you really see that he had a view of the public investment process just as much in terms of stimulating the economy through his wonderful concept of the multiplier, but also directing it towards what kind of society we actually want to live in. And I really think this has been lost in much modern-day Keynesian thought. I personally work a lot on the economics of innovation, and this is one of the most clearest places where you see, if you actually look at the kinds of policies that were required to get us the kind of innovation-led growth of the last 100 years through these different general-purpose technologies, which are general in the sense that they really transform production, distribution, and even consumption across the whole economy. This is not just sectoral. You really see this very active Polanyi-esque policy-making process, which absolutely, in some parts of the world, very much shaped and created markets. Move on. And you know, just think of the point I was making before in terms of the public good problem. When you think of innovation, and there's all this talk now about innovation-led growth, you have Theresa May bringing back this priority of industrial strategy, there's often this notion, again, that you're just going to sort of put some investments here and there, and of course we need a lot of basic research, and we'll need some venture capital finance here, and we'll need potentially some procurement down there, but more or less you want the state to come in and, again, fix those problems, when actually when you look at whether it's Silicon Valley or China today, which is absolutely leading in different areas, of which green is one, but also telecoms, so Huawei, number one in the world in the telecom sector, what you actually see is this decentralized network of different types of public actors, which have absolutely been essential across the whole innovation chain in providing exactly those kinds of investments that are not coming out of the private sector, but not just because of these different types of failures, but also because the vision itself of different types of agencies, and I've personally studied lots of different types of these public organizations, what often was required was for them also to be mission-oriented, actually having a vision for, again, what do we actually want in terms of, the nanotech sector or the IT revolution or green, which I'll come to in a minute. And this notion that there's something out there that business wants and that then they would come to government asking for different types of favors misses the point that actually what we've seen, whether it's through the Medical Research Council in this country or the National Science Foundation or DARPA, which is absolutely important for the internet, was also this ability for these organizations to dream, to think about what sort of transformation, what sort of directed investment do we actually require. I often talk about the iPhone and simply because this talk that somehow in Silicon Valley what was there was lots of venture capital and entrepreneurs and garage tinkers, and we then have to reproduce that here in order to get this innovation-led growth, completely misses the fact that what actually makes many of our products that we carry around in our pockets smart and not stupid were different types of public investments, whether it was coming from the CIA, which unfortunately was very important for a touchscreen display, or DARPA Internet, DARPA again for Siri, or GPS, which of course Uber also would be nothing without, coming from the Navy. This way in which actually in so many different sectors what the private sector was able to do was surf a massive wave of different types of public investments, which is fine, right? The problem is whether do we actually describe it that way. So an 800-page book on Apple, where not one page, not one paragraph, not one sentence, not one word describes any of this public investment, that then becomes the problem. That's the narrative problem, the discourse problem. And this isn't just about innovation. This is literally about how do we talk about this value creation, wealth creation process? Do we talk about it as just the government sitting in the background, cheerleading and steering some background horizontal framework conditions, or actually having been one of the lead investors themselves? And it's not just in terms of, the military-industrial complex kind of things, and all over the world, much of the drug industry itself, so the new medicines that are being required, whether it's vaccines or the Ebola crisis or many of our blockbuster drugs, it's actually been public funding from different types of health institutions. This is just the funding from the U.S. National Institutes of Health, which have actually been responsible for something like 75% of the new molecular entities with priority ratings, so the most revolutionary new drugs. So it was absolutely astounding to me when Obama came up with this great vision for Obamacare, which was very, very important because 60 million people in the U.S. were not insured, when he was accused of meddling in people's healthcare choices, what he basically gave was an explanation of why that was the right thing to do. He didn't talk about social democracy, but basically his explanation was a very social democratic one on why it was correct to use government's regulation policies to create a fairer system. But what he should have also said at the same time, in parallel, was meddling. Did you just say meddling in your healthcare choices? We have absolutely been co-creators over all these years of the healthcare market itself. That completely changes the narrative. It doesn't mean you win the point. It doesn't mean that Obamacare all of a sudden gets seen by the whole population as something wonderful, but it absolutely changes the vocabulary through which a progressive politician, if you think Obama was a progressive politician, would then be talking to the Tea Party kind of critiques. And this vocabulary, the discourse, the narrative is just as important as the economic theory, but the two have very much been related. So this market failure theory approach has led to a quite boring, lame, and static way through which, even when we believe in different types of state investments, we at best talk about it as redistributional, not having created the system in the first place. In green, which again Michael talked about, if you look around the world, and there's actually some great data on green, unlike for some other sectors, what you see is, again, the really difficult areas with high technological and market uncertainty, and especially high capital intensity, having been, again, across the world, been characterized by different types of public investments. Because don't forget that actually what we're talking about when we talk about innovation is a highly uncertain process, which takes a very long time, and the kind of finance that's actually required is not any kind of finance, but patient, long-term, committed, strategic finance. And so even the word, the credit crunch, which continues to be used in different moments, there's never been a credit crunch. There's never been a lack of finance. It's always been a lack of what kind of finance, and this overly speculative and short-term type of finance has absolutely been part of the problem in terms of financialization and the kind of finance that has ended up financing finance. But it's interesting to look in terms of green, the different types of public finances like public investment banks, and this is actually just four public banks, the German, the Brazilian, the Chinese, and the European Investment Bank, providing huge amounts of finance to not just do the kind of counter-cyclical financing, right? Again, this is the crisis times, they have a public bank in Germany, the KfW, increasing the amount of lending while the private banks were taking it away, but also directing that finance towards Germany's green vision around Energiewende. And we have a very hard time talking about this in economics. We assume that these public actors, again, should just be kind of spraying support across the economy, but the direction of the economy should be chosen by the market, which I've already said is a very problematic way to see. Because what we actually mean in that case is business. The market itself, again, is an outcome of these different types of interactions. And it's really interesting then if you look at the evaluations of these types of programs, and there's many evaluations, for example, of these public banks, this notion that they're somehow crowding out the private banks often has been done without a proper dynamic analysis of the way that these different public institutions have absolutely created something new that wasn't there. By the way, the most interesting example I always talk about is the BBC. So the BBC Charter Review, if you actually look at all the analysis that was done over the last 3 years, there's very little dynamic economic analysis of actually being able to measure what the BBC did in terms of transforming the broadcasting landscape, even in the 80s, say, with the learning program where they wanted all the kids to code, where that was part of the whole BBC Micra, which then crowded in the Acorns and the Arms, which we've just proudly sold to the Japanese SoftBank. If you look at what the BBC has done in terms of the learning program, but also investing in-house in things like the iPlayer, but also not just sticking to the public good problem, so, high-quality news and boring documentaries about giraffes in some part of Africa, but even things like soap operas and talk shows, they never limited themselves just to fixing the public good problem, but actually had a notion of social and public value, which, by the way, we can talk about in philosophy, but in economics, we don't even have that word. We don't talk about public value and social value. We just talk about fixing the public good problem. And it sounds good, because it says public good, but actually when you look at it, it's an extremely narrow space. As soon as a public bank goes beyond that, or a BBC kind of institution goes beyond that, they get accused of crowding out or picking winners, et cetera. Let me speed up a bit. The China Development Bank, if you're interested in what's happening in green, absolutely look at it. There's a great book, by the way, by two Bloomberg journalists called The China Development Bank, Changing the Rules of Finance. And these numbers might look huge to you, the amount of money that this bank is putting, betting on particular companies, some of which fail. Any venture capitalist will tell you this is normal. You know, for every success, you'll have seven or eight failures. But when you look at the same thing happening in the U.S., which I was kind of talking to you about before in terms of the iPhone kind of example, very similar numbers. So even just Elon Musk, you know, the new hero of Silicon Valley, got $5 billion from the U.S. government. And one of his companies, Tesla, just to get the Tesla S car off the ground, required that patient, long-term, committed finance. And we have three chapters, actually, in the book that look at the patient finance problem. But, you know, for every Tesla, you're going to have a Solyndra. Which was instead was a bankruptcy. And instead of just focusing on, oh, government screwed up with Solyndra, what are you doing, another Concord, actually understanding that government as not just lender of last resort, but also investor of first resort, will have to, by definition, have these kind of portfolios, but mission-driven around whether it's a green strategy or a big IT strategy, going beyond just a sectoral strategy, will inevitably have some failures. And really how to structure those portfolios so they remain wide, not putting all our eggs in one basket, but also thinking about how to get perhaps some of the upside success to cover those downside losses, especially when it's about downstream investments, not just the, you know, upstream basic science investments, is a big challenge. Carlota Perez, who wrote a chapter in the book, she often says, hey, well, you know, stop just talking about these supply-side policies. It's also the demand side. And by demand side, she's not just talking about procurement, as important as procurement is, but she says, for example, we should be thinking about green as a new direction for the whole economy. She says that in the same way that mass production, which was one of those general purpose technologies I put up in the beginning, had a huge effect on the economy, but would not have had that effect without demand side policies like suburbanization, she says we should be thinking about green today in that sense as, for example, a new direction even for the IT revolution, which has not had yet the full effect it really could have across the whole economy. So green as a direction, not just in terms of renewable energy investments. This requires, again, bold Keynesian kind of policies, not just in terms of countercyclical finance, but that laissez-faire quote I put in the beginning, which is really do what's not being done at all and think of it in terms of the whole supply side. Now, this is not about saying, let me just jump ahead a bit, that the state should do everything. What, in fact, many of these investments have done is crowded in private sector investment. The whole point of, you know, Keynesian animal spirits is also, you know, that what drives business investment are not just tweaks to the tax system or to interest rates, but you have to get business excited to actually want to invest. And in fact, animal spirits themselves, I think, have been misunderstood by many people because it's sort of been hijacked by the behavioral finance people. What Keynes really meant is that what drives business investment are the gut instincts of where future opportunities are. And what we have seen is different types of policies. I'll tell you why this graph is up here in a second, where public sector activity, when it was, you know, dreaming and having a vision and mission-oriented, actually then got business excited to enter different sectors. So that big wave I showed you before for the health spending, in fact, then got business excited to actually do biotech. And the venture capitalists came in 30 years after that sort of red carpet was laid out. But even if you just look across the world, you see very different amounts, not just of public spending. This is showing public spending in terms of helping businesses spend on R&D, but different characteristics of that spending. And this is very important because some countries, like my own, Italy, have lots of public spending, but it's often in subsidies. It creates a parasitic relationship with business. These are indirect mechanisms. It's not direct. So these blue lines here are indirect programs where government tried to get business to invest, say, in R&D through some sort of tax incentive. The gray part is direct spending, which is actually what I've been talking about. And there's lots of really interesting research which somehow hasn't had a big effect in the policy space, because unfortunately so many times when policymakers say we want this kind of growth, what do we need to do? We need to incentivize business to invest. Let's reduce their costs through some sort of tax incentive, whereas actually we have very little evidence that creates additionality. Additionality meaning getting business to do what it would not have done anyway. Otherwise, just reducing business costs might reduce their increase their profits, but the point of policymaking is not to increase the profits of business, it's to increase their investment. And why do we need that? Precisely for the reasons that Michael showed us, with this very lagging level of business investment across the world, increasingly with this financialized system. This is just a great letter that Keynes actually wrote to Roosevelt, where he kind of admitted this. He's like, oh my God, I've been using this word animal spirits, but you know what? I don't really see that many tigers and wolves and lions. I see a bunch of domesticated animals out there. And unfortunately, this point about how do you get the domesticated pussycats to actually want to roar and turn into that lion and those animal spirits, this again has sort of been missed. And even in the boom, you kind of require this visionary understanding of where might we transform an economy, what kind of investments might we need. And in fact, almost all the iPhone investments that I mentioned before were actually done in the boom. And so getting away from this notion that we just need counter-cyclical investments, but also admitting that this is about transformation, and it's not a coincidence that Polanyi's book was called The Great Transformation. I will actually stop now because I think the best thing would be to get some discussion. Let me just say a last thing on inequality and the whole inclusive growth dimension. This is the famous data by Piketty, this U-shape showing how much inequality has increased since the 1970s. He then talked about different remedies, of which one was the wealth tax and this notion that somehow you need different types of taxes to redistribute income. Absolutely true. Very important. What I've been trying to argue quite a bit, and I talk about this in my chapter in the book, in our book, Rethinking Capitalism, is what actually happened in this period was not just that we had regressive taxation, for example, capital gains tax falling by 50%, from 40% to 20% in just 5 years. And by the way, capital gains tax is a tax that shouldn't necessarily be very low. We should have low taxes which incentivize, even though I just said it's not just about incentives, business to make long-run investments. Capital gains is what you make from short-run investments. There's no reason to have it that low. What's interesting is why that happened. And if you look at the history of capital gains tax falling, it very much was lobbied for by particular actors through this narrative, this discourse, this vocabulary about wealth creation. So it was in that case, in the U.S. at least, it was the National Venture Capital Association that by describing themselves as the innovators, and if we want an innovation economy, we need capital gains tax to fall. It's that kind of discourse that I think governments worldwide need to be much more confident in terms of engaging with. So this is not just about tinkering with the tax system, but really reflecting how it should be an outcome of our understanding of where investment, animal spirits, and wealth creation come from. And Warren Buffett, who is a famous communist, knows this very well. He said, why did you reduce my capital gains? I don't even look at it. I look for opportunities. And very much what I've been sort of trying to tell you for the last 20 minutes is what we really need today is a progressive agenda focused on this, focused on where can we learn over the history of capitalism that these big opportunities actually came from, which led to transformation today. The green transformation, I think, is the big priority. But understanding, again, the public activity as part of that process in transforming society, business itself having to become excited about increasing its own investment. Otherwise, what we get is this extreme financialization. This is the Lozonic data that that Jacobs talked about, Michael talked about, where you have all sorts of different companies across many sectors that today are spending more share buybacks and dividends than what their net earnings are, dipping into their capital reserves. And the proportion of that spending of their repurchases of their stock to boost stock options and executive pay in proportion to things like human capital formation spending or an R&D is skyrocketing. And this has been part of the lack of this deal on socialization of investment that Keynes talked about. We shouldn't forget that some of the most important private sector companies that did invest in innovation did so because there was interesting deals. So this need for reinvestment, in an era in which we have record-level hoarding, over $2 trillion in the U.S., 2 trillion euros in Europe being hoarded, not spent, inert capital, could actually be part of a new deal, literally a deal, though, a contract that business has with government. So AT&T that set up Bell Labs, which was literally one of the most innovative private laboratories for innovation, came from government saying to AT&T, you're a monopoly. That's not a God-given right. That's a right you get from government. And the deal is you reinvest your profits back into the real economy, back into innovation, big innovation, not just your little telecom stuff. And we don't have today that kind of deal making. And I will stop.
Okay, well, we've heard a lot of points there, and we're a little bit squeezed for time, so I'm just going to ask everyone to be kind of super succinct in their questions, and I'll just direct them, I think, and not expect every question to be answered and ask the panel, the speakers, to be super succinct as well. I think I'll start by taking three questions. Can I start with the gentleman at the hat, with the hat at the back? Just before you speak, can you say who you are and where you've come from?
Hi, good evening. My name is Cyprian Edmonds.
Sorry, you have to speak a little bit louder so we can...
Good evening. My name is Cyprian Edmonds. I'm from Wimbledon, South London, the poor end. I just wanted to say thank you very much, both of you. Your talks were informative and insightful. What I wanted to ask Mariana, this question is aimed at yourself. I've noted over the past month, from the summer onwards, think tanks seem to be moving towards a more holistic way of dealing with the economics for the future. I attended a talk with the New Economic Foundation in the summer, and more recently, Maria Contreras-Sweet came to the House of Commons, the Small Business Administrator, came to talk about small business. And what I'm noting of late is that there seems to be a movement towards what you're referring to about devolving and taking away, if you like, and working more with government and giving more independence towards the private sector, if that's what I'm hearing you're saying. But it's the mindset, and I'm trying to get around that. In general, do people have the openness to work that way? Because, for example, at the New Economic Forum, they were looking at the Rights of Nature, which is an economic plan or model, which is quite successful in Bolivia and Nepal. But I don't know if it would be deliverable over here or in Western Europe.
Great. Look, thanks a lot. I would ask people to be succinct, because otherwise we're just not going to get through many questions. Can I just see there was... this gentleman with the beard here, please.
How do we get big infrastructure projects? You know, like Heathrow, for example. Or can you hear me that? Mm-hmm. How do we get big infrastructure projects going? Because they're kind of Osborne when he was in kind of shovel ready, but we always have this big problem of actually a political problem of actually making decisions.
Okay, thanks. That was a model of succinctness. Can I have the woman with the Berkeley the outfit on?
Hi, thank you for both of your speeches. First, I have a point of clarification. Perhaps you could give an example of the direct support you were referring to. And my question is, would all these initiatives, such as trying to fund smart cities and trying to have these technology hubs in all these different parts of Europe, would these qualify as part of your solution, or would you want more? What exactly would qualify under your solution? Because it seems very much like there's a large emphasis on the narrative, changing the narrative rather than actually changing a lot of the solutions, right? So, yeah, if you could just elaborate on that. Thank you.
Okay. So we've got general policy shifts, airports, and this last point.
Yeah, I think we can do
the last one.
Well, the last one. Anyway, so the first question, this holistic issue, and you mentioned SMEs, one of the points is really that, you know, our policy should actually be coming from our understanding of how the system works, and I think that's what you mean by holistic. And so if you actually look at SME policy, it's usually really stupid. It's just spreading out a lot of money across a lot of companies that are not very productive, not very innovative, and to be honest, don't even create that many jobs in terms of net job creation. So at Cambridge, they have a Center for Business Research that shows that every year in the UK, we spend $9 billion on SMEs. When it actually gets to those few SMEs that are interested in increasing their investments and engaging with some, you know, innovation-led or green strategies, it's actually too little money. So, you know, if we really do want to just spread the money, why not spread it to the teachers, right? We know they're quite productive and, you know, important for society, but we have these myths about particular parts of the system. And if you look at SME policy, it's absolutely been a result of mythologizing some actors and not really understanding what's required in terms of driving, you know, this investment-led growth that I mentioned. In terms of infrastructure, that's quite important because what I was saying was it's not enough to do infrastructure. At the same time, we need infrastructure. The question is, what kind of infrastructure? So if you look at Energiewende's policy in Germany, this has been, you know, very much driving both their green infrastructure, but also their policies for their low-tech industry. So steel in this country, which ended up having to be bought up by Tata Steel, you know, had gotten quite inertial. The steel industry, which has also been important for parts of the infrastructure, at least that part that's made of steel, in Germany has completely transformed itself. It's become all about reducing the material content, so repurpose, reuse, and recycle, and that's been part of their green strategy. So by having, you know, visionary green, kind of a Carlota Perez kind of green directional strategies, it affects both what kind of infrastructure, but even how we think about these low, you know, lower tech areas. I'll let you do the smart city area because you've worked on that.
Yeah, so just to say about infrastructure, building airports and roads is difficult because they're always opposed for understandable environmental reasons. We built lots of infrastructure over the last 10 years in the energy field, particularly in renewable energy, which has grown hugely in the UK as well as in Germany and other countries. And without those problems, until a Conservative government decided that it would place planning restrictions on onshore wind, but we've had offshore wind, and offshore wind's been a very interesting example of Mariana's argument about demand creation as well as supply side. So in order to build offshore wind, you need big wind turbines, you need investment in those things. So there's been, as she's pointed out, the European Investment Bank and to some extent the Green Investment Bank, which is a British version of a state investment bank, rather micro, now being privatised, unfortunately, have been important investors in offshore wind. But the British government, the Labour government, did something else, which it said, look, you need wind turbines if you're going to build offshore wind farms. Where are they going to be made? And at the point that big expansion occurred in 2008-09, all the wind turbines for the North Sea would have been made outside the UK. So the British Labour government said, this is ridiculous. We should be making these wind turbines if we're going to do this in the UK. And for a variety of industrial policies, encouragement to invest, we now have 6 major wind turbine manufacturers in the UK which are making wind turbines for North Sea and indeed now Irish Sea offshore wind. And that was a kind of industrial strategy which had both demand and supply side. So the demand side was energy policy, which said we're going to do this through renewables, through offshore wind, and then the supply side says, let's build a British sector to do this. And this is the kind of example. And smart cities provides another example where a combination of demand for smarter cities, by which we mean using information technologies, renewable energy, energy efficiency, decentralised energy, and so on to drive a more efficient form of growth, can be done both through the demand side, but then also supporting the companies to do that, to provide the goods and services that make it possible. And some of those technology hubs and other things I would certainly characterise as good examples of kind of mission-oriented investment led by the state, often the local state, not the national state in these cases. And I think there are some very interesting examples of this. Just to answer the first question, I think there is a minor shift that has gone on literally over the last 3 months towards a thinking about economic policy which is a little bit more of our kind. It's minor because it's only just started and we don't really know how far it can go. But it is very interesting that the Theresa May government, after the Brexit vote, has started talking about industrial policy in a way that the previous government did not at all. Minor, but nevertheless a little bit of fiscal relaxation, acknowledging that there does need to be some stimulus and some investment in the economy. And the way the May government is talking about inequality, the gains from growth, started talking about workers on boards, although it's withdrawn from that, different forms of corporate governance, suggests that there might be just an inkling of a recognition that the former dominant economic policy, which said get the state out, austerity, no industrial policy, not interested in countering inequality, we may have seen a shift. Now, I think that is a micro shift right now, but it is interesting that even a Conservative government has begun to recognise, following the Brexit vote and in the recognition of the Trump vote, that the form of economy we've had and the form of economic policy is not now good enough. And if there is any... if there is any little shift there, then I think that's an interesting straw in the wind. I think it's very difficult to see why this government would go much further in that direction. But
can I just say something really quickly about your other part of your question on direct versus indirect? A direct policy is when you, say, want to be funding nanotech and you set up a national nanotech initiative, or if you want to be financing green, you do that kind of direct lending by, say, a public bank to companies that you think are green. Indirect, or things like the patent box, which, by the way, is a tax incentive policy which is extremely regressive and was set up by the coalition government as part of their industrial policy, because it's actually also true that the coalition government had already revived industrial policy. But it's not only doesn't work because many tax credits, again, don't really work in terms of producing additionality, but it's incredibly regressive. Why? Patents are already monopolies. You have 20 years of, you know, appropriating monopoly profits when you have a patent. The point of a policymaker is not to increase the profits coming from that patent, it's to increase the investments that lead to it, because the profits are already taken care of through your monopoly, you know, situation for 20 years. And this one policy in the name of industrial policy was lobbied for by one company, GlaxoSmithKline, one pharmaceutical company. So this whole issue of government failure is often, which Michael alluded to before, and government getting captured, and so government should sort of sit back so it doesn't get captured. Actually, government gets captured especially not in terms of whether it's small, medium, or large, its amounts of investments, but when it has no clue on how to engage with business and actually be demanding that business invest, as opposed to just sort of accepting different types of, you know, favors, and lots of these tax incentives end up just increasing profits and not having any effect on the, you know, big problem of missing investment.
Okay. Now, we've only got 10 minutes, so can I really just ask you to really be precise? There's a woman here with the glasses on, and then after that person, the woman with the scarf at the back.
Hi.
just your name and...
I'm Victoria. I'm a student in methodology. I was wondering, do you think that the euro is partly the product of this orthodox narrative? And if so, is it compatible with this new narrative you've talked about?
Okay, excellent question.
Hi, I'm Lizzie from E4 Tech. So I hear what you're saying about the mission-driven idea of the mission-driven economy. I just wondered if you could talk a little bit more about some of the potential drawbacks of that. I mean, two that immediately spring to mind are maybe not having a coherent vision for what that mission-driven economy might look like, and also the person that's providing that vision having quite a strong vested interest in what it might be. So maybe you could elaborate on those.
Okay, thanks. And, well, he stopped putting his hand up now. He's given up. That fellow over there, yep. Yes, you. Yep. Whoop. Nope. Him. Yep.
Hi, Owen, just an observer. Just a really quick question on the social contract. All of what you're saying makes so much sense, and yet when we have so much of the media right now being debated around benefits and you being an individual and someone in a transaction in every part of society, how do you push through that to explain this delineation between inequality and productivity?
Okay, now let's try and make it really quick and then we can get another round in. So...
So one thing with the euro is not the solution or the problem or the you know, it's neither bad or good. Sorry, where are you so I can look at you at least? There you are, sorry. One issue is, what, you know, can the euro work in an area, the eurozone, with such huge levels of inequality in terms of competitiveness? And the big failure of orthodox theory was its understanding of competitiveness. So what actually makes Germany core and Italy periphery is not that Italy has been spending too much. In fact, it hasn't. Italy's deficit, people don't realize this, Italy and Greece's deficit has been lower than Germany's for 20 years. They haven't been making all the kinds of strategic investments, and I'm just kind of being simplistic now. And so in Italy, we haven't had growth in productivity for 20 years. The denominator of debt to GDP hasn't grown. And so even if you have a modestly rising numerator, the deficit, which is your annual increase in your debt, but your denominator is not growing at all, in theory, the ratio can go to infinity, right? And so this need to understand that the kind of things that existed in Germany, these kind of linkages between science and industry, patient finance through a strategic public bank, not only higher than average R&D spending by both public and private, but also directed towards these, you know, energy event kind of missions, that part of the narrative of what the rest of Europe should actually be emulating isn't there. All we hear about is lower your unit labor costs, you know, get rid of your trade unions, do the Schroeder reforms. And the Schroeder reforms are really just to solve employment. When East and West united, you would have had massive unemployment. I'm not saying the Schroeder reforms were right, but what they ended up doing for competitiveness was very different from that.
So we've got drawbacks and social contracts.
Yeah, mission. So that's a really – sorry, where are you? There you are. So it's not, this is such a good question because, you know, Kennedy's mission, it was one guy, one white guy in America who thinks up the whole kind of man on moon thing. Is that what we're talking about? Well, in terms of, you know, challenges and having leaders who are actually willing to talk about directions, that whole man on moon thing was interesting, but it wasn't really the point. What was then required to get on the moon was about 400 different homework problems where a lot of bottom-up experimentation actually occurred, and almost all the investments I actually showed you in your iPhones came from as a spillover from that mission. But then the question is, what does that mean today? I mean, the man-on-moon kind of projects is not what we should really be thinking about. We should be thinking about how do we transform these big societal and technological challenges that we have, you know, again, inclusive growth, the sustainable growth, into concrete missions. So it's not just about fighting climate change or fighting inequality, which is really easy to talk about, but then it's like, well, what are we actually doing? Transforming them into concrete missions that can also be monitored along the way. But it actually should be the civil society and the democratic structure, I think, that comes up with these big challenges. A society has to decide, will we actually transform ourselves in a green direction? And it was actually the green movement in Germany. It wasn't a politician that sort of helped steer society towards that decision. But then you need policymakers that are bold enough to transform those challenges into concrete missions and also then enable this bottom-up process so it's not just top-down. There's lots of interesting lessons about the Soviet Union that we should learn about, and it's not about communism or capitalism. It's that this very top-down, narrow, big pots of money that kind of micromanage what happened versus a system of innovation. I'm at SPRU because of this whole system of innovation approach that was very important, precisely in understanding why did you have countries like Japan that were spending less on innovation than Germany, but actually structured that spending across the whole economy in this more decentralized way, still strong public actors, but not all top down. That kind of systems of innovation perspective is also quite important in understanding how these missions can be less of a top down thing.
Okay, Michael, do you want to talk to this point about social contract? Perhaps your new commission even might be relevant there.
So I'm not quite sure whether I have I've answered your point correctly, but I think we are living in a political moment when, following the Brexit vote, following the Trump vote, given movements around Europe, when inequality, and in particular not static inequality, but the unequal gains from growth in some of those charts that I showed you, there will be inequality. People understand that. It's the fact that the growth has been so skewed towards the top end of the income stream, has become a public problem. And in unusual elections, there have been large numbers of voters who appear to have expressed a view that is unacceptable to them and do not like being on the wrong end of that income distribution. What I don't think we have yet is a consensus about how to deal with it. And if you look at the responses to that, you see now very different kinds of responses. On the one hand, there are institutions that are doing business as usual. IMF is now imposing exactly the same conditionality on Greece now than it was doing for the last 5 years, and learned absolutely nothing. In the US, Trump looks like he's going to try and do this through protectionism, along with some federal spending on infrastructure. Not quite sure what that will add up to other than trade war if he goes through protectionism. The May government is struggling with what it might mean here, and who knows what it might mean in other countries. So I think we're living in a moment where the idea of a social contract in which we have to operate our economy for everybody, I mean, an economy that works for all is the slogan that we all now use, has moved back to the center of discourse, but I don't think we have any consensus about how that will actually be done, and I think it'll be done in different ways in different places. But it is a moment when then that idea of a social contract, it has at least a little bit more space for argument about it.
Well, I fear we do have to end. I mean, we've heard a very thought-provoking...
We can go over 5 minutes.
We have to ask these people who are employed here whether they want to stay longer, but... I fear we do have to end. I mean, we've heard a really interesting talk, I think. We first of all had set out for us a series of major structural problems, problems exacerbated by the intensity of the global financial crisis. And then we heard about a series of alternative prescriptions, prescriptions about innovation, about green growth, about dealing with inequality, all of which I think were built around the idea that there should be an alternative, more honest reckoning about the role of the public sector in delivering these kinds of goods. So there's a lot more about all of this in the book. The book's out there, and our speakers are going to stay here if you'd like to get them to sign your copy. But before you go and do all of that, can I ask you to thank our two speakers, Professor Marinelli.